Hello? What's the name of this intake?
Bat Segundo. We fear he may be suffering from narcissistic personality disorder.
Can I get my phone call?
Lacerations to the forehead. There's some strong evidence pinning him to the murder.
The least you can do is take off the handcuffs. Maybe one of you can give me a kiss or unzip my pants if you're feeling generous.
I've heard of this guy.
Is this about the alimony?
One of his correspondents tried to interview me. Claimed she was a reporter for the Los Angeles Times.
One of those online people, no doubt. I don't know how they make it past the velvet rope.
I have an introduction to record for my show.
I think there may be a conflict of interest.
What seems to be bothering you?
There's something gratuitous about all this horseplay. It's as if this Bat Segundo is a stand-in for somebody else.
He does seem to be deeply pathological.
Doris, is that you?
He's leading us down the garden path.
Well, it's the logical thing to do.
Okay, so I'm here with Patricia Cornwell, the author of many novels featuring Kay Scarpetta, the most recent being Scarpetta. Patricia, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. My first question is sort of a vaguely mathematical one, I suppose, in the sense that Scarpetta is being touted as the 20th anniversary of the creation of Kay Scarpetta, but of course Postmodern was published in 1990. So I just wanted to get a sense for the record, the exact chronology, especially knowing that there were three unpublished novels and sort of, you know, the genesis of Scarpetta in that light.
Well, the genesis of Scarpetta is I wrote three earlier books that I started in 1984 that featured her as a very minor character, where I decided to have a medical examiner because that's what I was interested in. Nobody else had been writing about it, and I thought this is an amazing world and I want to explore it. But those books never got published, and they probably never should. And when I began Postmortem, it was on the advice of an editor who said, you know, your most interesting character is this lady medical examiner, and you ought to make her the main character, which was a really scary thought for me. I went, wow, how am I going to write about somebody who is so smart and knows all these things? So that was the creation of Postmortem, where I finally made the book all about her. It was from her point of view, and that was the first book where she appeared full-blown as the character we know today, even though it was in, you know, an early state for her. I wrote that book and finished it in 1988. Now, when I was writing Scarpetta, this new one, I realized earlier in this year, 2008, and I went, my gosh, I finished the first one literally, you know, 20 years ago. That's really quite a milestone, and it's amazing. Now, the reason Postmortem didn't actually come out until January of 1990 is because it made the rounds in the publishing world for 6 to 8 months with everybody turning it down. And so finally, Scribner, then called Scribner's, right, took it on by, you know, a wing and a prayer, and they published it in January of 1990. But she languished for a while. In fact, I was already looking to go back into journalism because I just figured this was a failed career.
So 6 to 8 months, and in that time, from what I understand, that editor who you just referenced was Sarah Ann Fried.
That's right.
Who had been the legendary editor at Mysterious Press and died, regrettably, some years ago.
Yeah.
So what I was curious about in light of knowing this is, did she see Postmortem, and especially having given you such encouraging comments, and what happened? Why didn't she write?
These are very good questions, and you stretch my memory here. But as far as I know, what actually happened, this is really sad, is that Sarah Ann Fried had seen the first three books that never got published and are in a cardboard box in my archive somewhere. And she always gave very nice rejection letters. So when the third one was rejected, I called her, which was sort of a no-no. You don't call someone who's rejected your work. And she was nice enough to get on the phone with me. And I said, listen, should I quit? Because I'm clearly not any good at this. And she said, no, I don't think you should quit. She said, I really think you're going to make it someday at doing this. And I said, but what's wrong? She says, what's wrong is your best character is this medical examiner, Dr. Scarpetta, and you should make her the main character. And also, the things you're writing about, is that what you really see at the morgue? And I said, no, I really see pretty awful things at the morgue. And I was doing really fanciful kind of murder mystery type motivated tales in these earlier books. She said, I want to see what you see. And so I did Postmortem. She was the main character, told it from the first person point of view, and I wrote about serial killings because that's actually what I was seeing at the office at that time. When Postmortem made the rounds and I wrote this book, I was surprised because the Mysterious Press rejected it. And I found out later, now this is apocryphal because I can't validate it, I was told later that Sarah Ann Fried, when that crossed her desk, she thought it was simply a rewrite of one of my earlier books. She didn't realize I'd written a brand new one.
Oh,
and
really?
So that sort of lives in infamy, you might say, that Postmortem was turned down and then it went on to do what it did. But that's a sad story about that.
But on the other hand, then Suzanne Kirk, who is another... What's interesting, too, is that your career essentially started at the behest of very legendary people in the mystery world.
And then Suzanne Kirk found it
at Scribner and then picked it up from
and
there.
She was quite a champion for it, because the publishing house, again, from my understanding back then, was very dubious about it. This was so different. Nobody wrote books like this back then, really. First of all, you know, you had a serial killer who was a stranger to the victims and a stranger to everybody. And in the tradition of, quote, mysteries was, it's somebody in your midst. And there were so many traditions that I shattered, because real crime shatters those traditions. And I was writing about what I saw and really taking a journalistic point of view, although I was weaving it into fiction. And so, and some of the rejection letters were, nobody wants to read about morgues or laboratories. And certainly not a woman who works in an environment like this and sees what she does. It seems silly now, but back then, that just wasn't done. And so Suzanne, though, had the sort of futuristic vision to think, this is new and different and this is pretty cool, and I want to publish this book. But she had to get yet another opinion. She had to have another person read it, and they deliberated and they just barely decided on it. In fact, the telephone call I got, you know, the famous call that changes your life, it was iffy. It was, we think we're going to publish Postmortem, but we want to get one more person to read it.
So it had to go to the editorial board, in other words.
It was actually, I think, an outside consultant they had, someone they considered an expert, a man whose name I don't remember, and they needed one more person to look at it to see if they really were going to do this. And then that was my great turning point telephone call, was a maybe. And then they did decide to take it on. But it was a very small printing, 6,000 copies, you know, $6,000 is what I got paid. No advertising, no marketing, no nothing. And so by the time people discovered it, it was out of print and hardcover.
Well, then it was a question that Avon picked it up in paperback. And then after that, then things really accelerated.
Well, what happened, first, what really kicked it off is that it got awards. And in fact, one of the big things actually started in Los Angeles, because the rather legendary book reviewer Charles Champlin,
yes,
from the LA Times. I'll never forget, because I got this phone call and they said, you would not believe this review you just got from the LA Times for this. And it changed everything with the way the publisher looked at the book. It was like, wow, this thing just got a real standalone huge review by this legendary reviewer of the Los Angeles Times. And I was like on my head about it. I was amazed. And then it started winning all the awards too. You know, the Creasy and then the Edgar, and no one had ever done that, won both of those, and then it went on and won, you know, three more. And so to this day, that still holds a record for winning, sweeping all five of those. But it was not a bestseller, never made the bestseller list. And by the time it had been out for too long really to do it, probably. So, and I never thought I would make a bestseller list. I just thought, wow, I was really lucky and this one worked, and I hope somebody will publish something else.
But at that point, you'd already written Body of Evidence.
And
you were well into writing the third one as well.
By the time the Postmortem actually was out, I'd already written Body of Evidence, because I immediately started it when I finished Postmortem. And while it was making the rounds, I was dabbling with it. But then I was also doing job interviews, because I have to retract that. I'm not sure I'd started Body of Evidence until Scribner's took it, but then it took a whole year for it to come out, and so then I'd written the other book, and that was, you know, I had more time, it seems like, in those days. I would write, by the time the new one came out, I'd already written the one after it. I wish it were true now, but I can't seem to keep up as much as I used to.
Well, I do kind of want to touch on the question of, I guess, time management, but first I wanted to get a sense of points of view, since you'd already mentioned that before, and of course, Postmortem in the early books, they're exclusively from Kay's point of view. Mm-hmm. And I think you had actually brought this up on your website, but I did want to reiterate, why did you, I guess, switch to multiple points of view? And you certainly see that in Scarpetta, where you're getting Kay's viewpoint, you're getting the Gotham Gotcha folks, you get Marino and Benton and Lucy and Berger. It's like, you know, it's a whole party of people.
Right.
So why did you feel that you wanted to sort of open it up and incorporate multiple points of view?
Well, this literally happened when I wrote The Last Precinct, which came out in 2000. And as I really struggled through the book, and I was struggling with that book, I was feeling, I can't do this anymore. I'm about to hit a wall here. I'm bouncing off the inside of her skull. You know, it's like a sonnet, where I had this very little space and these very tight parameters to tell a story, and I was finding it harder and harder to do. And it was very interesting, because I also was playing around a lot with the movie business, because I was out in Hollywood a lot, working on screenplays and things. I mean, I've written so many movies that nobody's ever seen. I probably hold the record. But when I was working with directors, they would say, but how do I show that?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the kind of thing, the phone rings and Scarpetta thought that must be the labs, because everything's inside her head. And as I began more and more to work with people who wanted to visualize what I was saying, to show a story and not just tell a story, and as I began to feel very limited and having to tell a story and not be able to show it, I decided when I finished The Last Precinct, I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I can't do this again. I can't do this the same way. I've got to be able to stretch myself. I need to, and I want to see what other people see when they look at Scarpetta. And I want to know what these other characters are doing when she's not watching them, because that to me became challenging and fascinating. So I wrote the Jack the Ripper nonfiction book after The Last Right. Precinct. And when I did that, which was a little bit more of an omniscient point of view,
right.
I said, I like this. I want to write a book where I can tell a bigger story. So that's what I did. And in the one that followed it, Blowfly, which came out in 2003, I switched to the third person point of view. And yes, my readers have, I've had a lot who've complained about that. They really want it to be inside of her head. But what they don't understand is I can't tell the stories that way anymore. She doesn't want me in her head. I don't want to be in her head to the same degree. I want to see the full picture.
Well, there's some books that they incorporate first and third point of view. Is that something that you ever consider, where you keep Scarpetta's voice as first person, but then just bring in other points of view? Or was that just too muddled?
You know, I've played with all kinds of different things. And believe it or not, with the new one, Scarpetta, I actually started it. I said, you know what, I'd actually announced to my British and my American publisher, I said, you know what, I'm going to go back to the first person point of view because I really want to give my readers something they've been asking for. And it's been requested, will you go back to that point of view? And so I thought I would try it. And I actually started writing this book in the first person point of view. And after about 30 pages, I said, I can't do this. I can't do it. It's not going to be good. And so I went back and changed all the I's to she. But by doing it that way, what I actually did was I think I got a little bit more into her head. And so even though this new one is in the third person point of view, when you are with Scarpetta, hopefully there's an intimacy in terms of you're really feeling, you know what she's looking at, what she's feeling, and you feel that familiarity again. So I'm trying to still strike that balance where I need the freedom as a writer to tell a bigger story, but to also make you feel very much at home with her.
Well, that sort of goes into my next question, which is that you brought up in an interview with, I believe, The Telegraph, that a close friend of your former husband had commented that he felt that the characters had become almost too cold or too remote, and you realized, oh, I don't like them either, and you wanted to bring back the warm interaction. And I've seen elsewhere, even in interviews this week, we really talk about how character-driven Scarpetta is. So I guess the question is what was it that sort of struck you that you had to change to bring back that warm interaction between the characters?
Well, it was really interesting when this particular person said this. It's actually someone I went to school with, to college with, and he made this comment. He said, it's almost like she doesn't like her characters anymore, and I'm not sure I like her characters anymore. And at first I was very stung by this comment, but I thought about it, and I said, you know, he's kind of onto something. And I think this is the danger of a series. It's probably why long-running series like Cheers finally go off the air and everybody's all upset, but the actors go, I've got to move on and do something else. And I can really understand that, because after all these years of doing Scarpetta, I was like, you know, they don't really talk to me the way they used to. I'm not sure they like me anymore. I'm not sure I like them anymore. I'm not sure they like each other anymore. And they go through evolutions where, for example, Marino really needed to become as unlikable as he
became. He definitely becomes very unlikable.
He's a jerk. He became a real jerk, but he almost needed to become that in order to become something else. Because he started out as this bumbling, almost stereotype cop, you know, in Richmond, Virginia in 1990, who was sort of ignorant and spoke in this sort of stereotype vernacular, to a total misfit in the modern age. And we know he held this torch for Scarpetta, the unrequited sexual attraction love. Now, what are you going to do with that eventually? You can't have that forever. Something's got to give. And so it made sense that he would go through a certain evolution that would end really the way it did in Book of the Dead. But then now what do you do next? Either you recreate him or you get rid of him. And that's been the big question that a lot of the fans have been asking, that of course gets answered in this new book, is what happens to him. But it's all part of the transitions that are not only necessary, but I think are inevitable when you write a series for as long as I've had this one. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure if it goes on another 20 years, there'll be even more startling transitions that I can't even begin to predict right now, because some of it also has to do with who I am. I've changed too. I'm not the same person I was in 1990. I'm not even the same person I was 3 years ago. So this is, it's just all part of the ebb and flow of life. But fans are funny people in a wonderful sort of way. They want everything to stay the same, but yet they want it to change. Mm-hmm. Because if I told the same story in the same way, to a certain extent, they'd complain about it. But if I change it, they're going to go, wait a minute, you didn't used to write them like this. So they have to bear with me and also kind of excuse my dust, because I'm always under construction. And I really am trying to get better at this. Believe it or not, my goal for every book is to get better at what I do. And I experiment and I read. I dabble with reading some other authors to see what they're doing, you know, people I really respect as craftsmen and writers, because I'm trying to find what's the right way to say this so it really has immediacy and vitality and energy. And writing is frustrating because, unlike film or music, there's not an immediate impact on your emotions. You have to translate it. And I don't want to translate it. I want to, boom, just immediate have it go to your head, so to speak. And it doesn't work that way.
So I guess the question is, in light of this book being written for the fans, and yet fans have expectations and they want things to stay, so how do you sort of navigate what can often be a very tricky line between keeping your own vision of how the series and how Scarpetta and company are supposed to go with what readers want?
It's all about being honest. You know, I really do listen to what fans say. I don't always like it. I mean, ones that are reasonable, there are people, well, the people who aren't really fans. I mean, the people who just want to be nasty. But I do listen, because these are for them. I mean, I'm sitting in this apartment and having a nice life because people read my books. And so I'm very mindful of my audience. And when Benton Wesley died, the reason I brought him back is there was such a hue and a cry. And people said, were upset with me. And they kept saying, are you sure he's dead? And I thought, actually, I don't know. I didn't see it happen. And you know what? If they want him back that badly, then I kind of miss him too. Let's do it. So, I mean, that literally was because of what fans said. So I could give you a long list of things that have been influenced by things fans have said to me. However, I still am honest, because if I honestly can't do something they want, it doesn't feel honest to me and it doesn't feel right. I have to say, I'm really sorry about this, but I can't do it that way. It's not going to work. And a good example is going back to the first person point of view. I just can't eye this and eye that. And especially now, for example, in this book with Scarpetta being a chief correspondent, a forensic correspondent for CNN, for me to be sitting there writing about now that she's famous and dealing with the trials and tribulations of that, because she's sort of an unwilling celebrity in her own way, that would be extremely awkward if I were saying I this and I that, and it would sound unbelievably narcissistic. And people would say, oh, see, now she's really gone to her head. But it isn't me, it's her. And it's much easier, because I have that distance, to kind of let her do what she wants. And I tell you what, sex scenes are rough if you're doing it first-person point of view.
I suppose that's true, too.
It's really hard. I thought, you know, they're hard for me anyway, but I, for some reason, embarrass myself. But I really can't let her do as much as I want her to if I'm talking, you know, me this and I that. So I can't do everything the readers want me to do, but at the end of the day, they should be glad, because I am the writer, and hopefully I do know why and what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, that actually ties into my next question, which is, obviously Scarpetta really brings out Kay's sort of reluctant celebrity status and the whole storyline involving Gotham Gotcha, it really brings to mind the issue of privacy. And I know that privacy and sort of reluctant fame has figured, you know, to some degree in your own life as well. So I just wondered how you were sort of exploring this. And I guess the question is separating to some degree myth from reality, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Well, you know, the Scarpetta and actually all the characters give me a vehicle for exploring my own feelings. I mean, and actually dealing with my own feelings. And so if I have a very strong feeling about something in my life that might not have happened if I just lived a different way, whether it's, you know, aspects of my private life that have been revealed that are very personal to me, or whether it's even this whole notion of money and fame, which I never imagined as a kid. And yes, that's changed me. Yes, that's a different experience, and it causes me to have a range of feelings that I wouldn't have had. I want to impose those on at least one, if not several, of my characters, because it makes me feel better to do that, and it's interesting for me to explore it that way. And so I sort of use all the money in my bank account, you might say, whatever's been given to me emotionally or experience-wise, if I can do something with it in an interesting way in my books, I'm going to. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that I do this sort of thing.
But at the same time, too, I will admit that coming into this interview and getting this assignment and doing all the research, there are certain sort of almost, not necessarily preconceived notions, but certain sort of apocryphal myths that have popped up. You know, she carries a gun around and there's paranoia and the like. But as I've started to see with various interviews for this book, it seems like you're opening things up. You let an interviewer from USA Today into your home in Concord, Massachusetts. So I guess, how are you navigating your own sense of, I guess, opening things up versus keeping things, you know, relatively private and within yourself?
You know, some of it is, I've actually always been pretty open, but I think some of it is a different way the material is treated these days, too. I think that we are in a culture where people are much more interested and almost demanding about the details of people's lives. And, I mean, it's like reality television.
Sure.
It's like, hey, I want to see you go into the, I mean, literally, this is a true story. You know, I walk in the ladies' room and the reporter goes in there too. And I said, you know, it's the first time I've ever peed in front of a reporter. Well, okay, if that's what you want. I mean, and that literally happened. And so that would never have been done 10 years ago. The reporter wouldn't even ask it and wouldn't follow me into the bathroom. And I'm not saying this in a disparaging way at all. It's going, oh, well, I mean, everybody probably figures I go to the bathroom. So, but the fact is, things are different now, and you've got to figure out how to adapt. I mean, I'm going to draw the line in some cases, and I don't like everything that comes out, but it is what it is. And, you know, I think there's a certain amount of hypocrisy about people who complain about their private life as being violated. Well, then don't do the interviews. I mean, really, if you hate it that much, don't do the interviews, because it really is rather hypocritical. I mean, obviously, the media, the attention, is very helpful to somebody's career. I mean, I need people to know I have a book out there, and so I'm going to pay a price for it. You can't have it both ways. So I'm going to try to be a good sport about it. And at the end of the day, though, I adhere to the one standard that I will not bend about, and that is I have to be honest. I'm not going to lie to anybody, and I'm not going to pretend to be something I'm not. And the truth is, because people are asking much more specific questions and seem more interested in the truth, they're also finding out that some of what they've heard about over the years isn't true. I have never walked around with a gun everywhere I go. That's ridiculous, especially in this city where it's illegal.
Just coming out of the subway, there were cops going around with submachine guns. And,
oof.
And we were discussing how, you know, if you're not experienced with a submachine gun, you really shouldn't be carrying
it
around.
That's very true. But yes, it is true that I'm very security-minded, and I have a high level of security when it's needed, whether it's, you know, in public or not in public. I don't deny that. But I'm happy for people to know, you know, who I am. Whether they like me or not, I'd rather they at least make their judgment based on fact.
Well, you also brought up, too, in the USA Today interview how, to some degree, it's like people would really be surprised to know that I hang out at home and I watch Blades of Glory and White Chicks and the like. So I guess to that end, you know, what about Patricia Cornwell would also further surprise people in light of, you know, the sort of, you know, persona, be it whatever you've presented or the media has presented, you know, in lieu of your own hopes and the like, you know?
Well, you know, the truth is, it probably is, if I really think about this hard, I bet you in my earlier years, I probably was a little more conscious of people having a certain image of me, maybe because I thought that they thought I was this Kay Scarpetta character, and I'm not. I mean, obviously, I can think like her. I couldn't think for her in my books. I mean, clearly, I have a certain ability to do that and a very good grasp of the world she lives in. But I also am me, and she probably doesn't watch White Chicks and Blades of Glory. In fact, I dare say she wouldn't. She might. I don't know what all she watches. She probably doesn't watch television much at all. She's reading journal articles. And probably people that used to think that's what I do. I don't. The fact is, I have a very lowbrow sense of entertainment a lot of the time. I deal with such heavy matters most of the time that I really like escapism. In fact, when Stacy and I eat dinner at night, and we usually park ourselves in front of the TV, it's usually let's watch something mindless, something that is painless, that doesn't ask much of us, and that actually I love to laugh. It's such a relief. And I love ridiculous humor. I do think Blades of Glory is like roll on the floor hilarious. I don't need a very highbrow humor, but I also think it's clever. And so, I mean, I don't like goofy, crude type of, you know, humor.
So I take it like the Judd Apatow school might not be your sensibility in terms of movies, or...
I'm not even sure what that is.
Like Knocked Up.
No.
Superman, okay.
No. I mean, I'm thinking it's fine that other people like that, and I wouldn't judge them for it, but no, that's probably not for me. I have a much more, I think, a rather gentle sense of humor. But for example, are you familiar with the British series Ab Fab?
Oh, yeah.
I love that. You know, some episodes more than others, but when that's funny, that is falling down funny. I really, really like it. And so, but maybe I just don't care anymore whether people are impressed with that or not. You know, if they think, oh my God, she's so disappointing. You know, I met her and she actually likes white chicks. I'm horrified. You know, and here I thought she watched Amadeus 5 days a week, you know? And so, and I thought maybe she was reading fine literature. And I do occasionally, but the truth is I probably read a big old stack of newspapers, you know, because I love to see what's going on in the world. So I guess there probably is some truth that at this stage, where I've been around half a century now, I sort of don't care. It's, you know, this is who I am. And I'd rather you not have a false impression of me, quite honestly, because you're going to be disappointed, and it causes me to try to live up to something I can't. You know, take me or leave me, but here's what I am.
So on that note, I'm going to just switch gears a little bit and talk a bit about not the book so much, but all your other involvement in forensic science and the like. And I know that this year you donated in two series a grant to John Jay College of Criminal Justice and another one to the Harvard Museum of Art. And I just wondered, well, first of all, in one case, it's a brand new association. In another case, this has been a longstanding association for a while. But why those particular institutions?
Well, it's for one thing, I see a huge need for forensic training. In fact, I think that we're in a lot of trouble if we don't get more training out there, simply because the things people watch on television and all, there's such a high expectation of what police are supposed to do and what the scientists are supposed to do, and the caseloads are out, you know, just out in left field. They're so crazy because more and more can be tested as evidence. So where there might have been one piece of evidence or 10 pieces turned in, now you get 50. So the labs are overwhelmed. We need more people to do the work, and they need to be properly trained. And so this has been a mission of mine for the better part of a decade, where I've tried to invest in a charitable way in things that will help the real people in the field, who are not only my heroes, they're my friends. And if I can help establish an institute in Virginia like I did that trains forensic scientists and medical legal death investigators, or if I can help the National Forensic Academy in Tennessee where I'm still involved, or I can help John Jay to maybe do something that will again expand the training opportunities for the practitioners and even for graduate students, this has been something that's important to me for a while. Obviously, if it wasn't for education, I wouldn't be where I am, because my career is ongoing education, and these people have been kind enough to teach me what I know. And so if I can help in any way with the training that gives back to them, that's something that's special to me. The Harvard Art Museum, I've been involved with them because of the Jack the Ripper project.
Sure.
And I've donated all of my Sickert art to them, and they approached me about wanting to create a chair for inorganic science, which is very important in art conservation and art research, where you're, for example, gold might be used in a paint during the Renaissance period, and you need inorganic science to use something like a scanning electron microscope with EDX to determine the elemental composition of what's in a Rembrandt, which to me is like, wow, that's cool. I love that, you know? And so when they asked if I would do this, I thought about it and I said, you know, this would be interesting, and it's adding something that's almost of a forensic nature to the world of art. And so I do try to be helpful. I mean, the charitable contributions are very, very important to me, because I feel that I've been given a lot and I must give something back. And I do it on lots of different fronts when I can.
Now, with the Virginia Institute, you had founded that, but I take it that you're no longer involved with that institution?
Well, they sort of don't need me anymore. I mean, I did what I did to really get them started, and I also used to live there.
Sure.
And so, and some of the principals involved have since retired, and I'm not in Virginia and haven't been for 8 years. So although I'm still friends with some of the people, it's not like I have no communication. I'm not literally involved.
You went to Marcella Fiore's retirement party.
I did. And in fact, I still have close contact with her. Sure. We're good friends. The National Forensic Academy, I am more involved because they're still kind of new and they're growing and they're really trying to set down their anchors and their roots. And I'm still involved with them. I was just down there the other day, as a matter of fact. And I'm very interested in what they do. And I also enjoy participating because I learn things from them as well. So John Jay is new. I'm not sure what my involvement will actually be, except that I hope there's some kind of, this is all new, it's not really been formed yet, but there's something that will come of this that will be helpful to the criminal justice community. Sometimes when you do things for people, they don't really need you as much as they simply need your support. I mean, they're not necessarily needing me to plan things and do, be actively participating.
Right. I mean, I did wonder, too, when you donate a certain amount of money, and I know that with the John Jay grant for the Crime Scene Academy, it's going to be, I think, $250,000 each over a period of 4 years. And from what I understand, I was talking with Lawrence Kobylinski over there, and he had said that although the press release had gone out in February that they were hoping to have it up and running in the fall, they still don't have it up and running because they're still looking for someone to spearhead it.
I think that they're also trying to figure out exactly what they're going to do. I mean, these things, if you don't have anything that's existent, it's not easy to put this together. And I think we don't yet know what this is going to be. And it may not be a bona fide academy, is it could be even some sort of consortium where you offer some sort of training where you hold conferences or something where people come and they're the guests of John Jay, but it's in conjunction with the criminal justice community such as NYPD or the labs or the medical examiner's office. I don't think it's really known yet. There's still a lot of planning that has to, in fact, I've got a meeting in like 2 weeks over there. And so I think it's, you also have to, and I'll tell you something else, with what's happened to the economy,
sure,
that's going to change the plans that people have because people are just struggling for money. And you can't, you couldn't possibly establish a long-running academy for $1 million. So we may have to scale this down and figure out what you can do with what all of us have, with what they've got. Because everybody is really rather much in dire straits, and it's a very different landscape than it was even a year ago when I made my first contribution to them.
Which is interesting, too, because when that press release had gone out in February, soon after you had taken out full-page ads in various newspapers trying to explain instances where you felt like you had been misquoted.
I was.
Now, looking ahead to now, do you feel as if, A, that was a good investment to make?
It was an unfortunate investment, but I had to make it, and I would do it all over again because that was a situation. And it probably wouldn't have happened if I'd had a publicist on the phone. I'm not faulting the reporter.
Sure.
It was just simply that something got taken out of context. And what I was really talking about were what citizens do at crime scenes. And it got interpreted that I was saying that, acting like I was almost making fun of the police. Mm-hmm. And I knew this was going to, I went, oh my God, this is going to make the fur fly. This is not good. And the last thing I would ever do is insult the police. And I'm trying to be supportive of them, not to make fun of them. And so there was a number of discussions, and we all said, you've got to do this as a preemptive strike. So that, because if I do it after someone complains, it just looks like I'm reacting, and that there wasn't a problem until someone else decided there was a problem. So that was a sad situation. And I know I didn't like spending that money, but I did what I thought was necessary because I did not and do not ever want anybody in law enforcement to think that I am judging them when what I'm trying to do is say, listen, I'm a big fan of yours and I'm trying to be helpful. Who wants to spend that kind of money on ads? That's not even good publicity. People go make fun of you for it. You get criticism for that sort of thing, but too bad. I will have the truth known if I can possibly do it.
Two more questions. One is just to bring up the Ripper case, because you had said that when certain copyrights on letters expire in 2012, that either your investigation would begin again or you're prepping to have certain evidence looked at again. And so first I wanted to check if that was indeed the case. And related to that, what's interesting too, is that obviously the Ripper is a very famous case and people are very interested, But of course, when it comes right down to it, no matter who the ultimate culprit is, be it Sickert or somebody else, they're all dead. So do you feel like, how do you compare, say, an investment in this case versus, say, an investment in a cold case that's happening now, where perhaps your input might, you know, benefit in a really crucial way?
Well, the funny thing is, with Jack the Ripper, first of all, I didn't pick that case in a way it picked me. I mean, I kind of fell into that, and then I went, how the hell did this happen? And I had no idea what that investment was going to be till I was already in it. And by then, it was there's no going back. I mean, this is an example of something that you get into like, oh, I'm just going to raise the Titanic. I mean, it's almost that big and in some people's minds preposterous that you have no idea, you know, 8 years later, you're still doing it. I would never have wished that on myself. In fact, in retrospect, there are times where I wish it never happened. I wish I'd never heard about it. I wish I'd never gotten involved in it because it's been a monstrous undertaking. It doesn't go away. I'm still involved in it because now I can't just quit because it's not convenient or financially sound. I have to continue to do the research until it's done. And we're not that far from, I think that probably within the next 2 years, hopefully I will have wrapped up as much as I possibly can about this. I actually have a very fine historian in the UK who is doing a lot of research with documents and has been for the last year and a half, because I can't do that. I need somebody over there to do that, and I have a life to live, and he's actually better at it than I am anyway. You know, we've continued turning over every stone we can about any DNA that's possible, although the truth is those samples are so contaminated, I'm not sure what more we can really do, although that's been ongoing as well. So it's like, you know, you got on this ship and you got to sail it to the end. You can't just jump off of it. And yes, it's not cases that are going to change anything or cause an arrest to be made because it's so old. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, these are real cases. They are real people who died, and they do deserve justice. And originally, my whole theory had been, listen, you know, maybe we'll learn something more about how to investigate cases if we can apply modern science to something this old and actually have it tell us a story. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we still can learn something from this investigation. But whether people think we do or we don't, or people think it's a waste of money or not, the fact is I got into it, and I'm not going to quit just because it's no longer convenient. I mean, this whole bit that I'm obsessed with it, if people knew just how bored I am with it at times, that'd be one of those disappointing things like Blades of Glory. But because the truth is, I'm like, oh my God, do I really have to read these 5 emails today that have to do with stuff that's going on in England about this that I have to address? And yes, I will have to do the revision. Is that something I'm really looking forward to? I'd rather write another novel. But I will finish my job because it's the right thing to do. I think it would be irresponsible for me not to.
So that brings me to my last sort of chunky question, which is ultimately, and I know that you have said already that you're working on the next Scarpetta book, but at the same time, wherever you go, if you shape public, if you donate money, or you're working on the Ripper case, you know, your name, as it relates to, say, criminal justice or public policy, certainly adds a certain cachet, or people certainly take notice. So, do you foresee a time when you might go further in that direction, or is it always going to be the novels first?
Well, there hasn't been anything I've really been asked to do that would interfere with the novels. I mean, I think that when it comes to the real decision makers out there about criminal justice, the truth is I don't think that their first thought is, oh, I wonder what Patricia Cornwell would have to say about this. I wish that were true. Now, they might wonder what Scarpetta would say about it if she were sitting in this room right now, but I'm an English major. They probably don't care. I mean, so I don't, but to answer your question in a fanciful way, I mean, I guess if somebody asked me to do something that really, really could make a huge difference, I'd have to really think about that, because I do feel a certain social responsibility just in general. That's kind of the person I am. But I sort of feel that I can do a lot more good by being me and doing what I do well and letting other people be more involved in the politics of it or the policy making. There's a lot of very well-informed, intelligent people out there that probably have a whole lot more to offer than I do, or even if they don't, I'm not sure that people sit around thinking, you know, that they really covet my opinion on something. I don't know. I haven't been asked. I guess if I got asked, I'd have to face it at the time. But I would not ever want something. I hope nothing ever really interferes with my career, because I really feel that's who I am. And I feel that if I feel that that's probably how I'm best able to contribute to other people and to help them, or if nothing else, give them something they want. That seems to be, you know, that's the song I sing. And I hope I don't get asked to sing something else that maybe I won't do as well or might even cause a problem.
So it's not a question of, say, I know you were a supporter of Hillary Clinton, and now with the transition team sort of announcing things, that if they were to have some kind of forensic science policy initiative, that they would come to you.
Let me just tell you something. If this new administration, and they won't, but if they did, ask me to do something helpful, especially as much trouble as this country's in, of course I would try to help. Absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, we live in the real world, and I live in this real world, and we're in really scary times. I mean, the level of anxiety everywhere you go is palpable, and it really hurts my heart to see people frightened and wondering if they're going to lose their jobs next week, or if their newspaper's going to go out of business, or their television station, or whatever. I've noticed that on book tour, this tremendous level of fear everywhere. And among authors, I mean, I could give myself up to it, too. I try to keep it at bay.
How do you keep it at bay, then?
I'll tell you what I do. First of all, we have to start with the assumption the world is going to go on. Mm-hmm. And if it's going to go on, then people are going to continue to have certain needs. And so we all, if we do our job well, can find a place somewhere, let's hope. And so I carry on by saying, first of all, I need to take care of the moment and do my job well, whatever it is. Because if I sit there and worry about the future and don't do what I'm supposed to do today, I will be in trouble. And then I'll have nothing to contribute to myself or anybody else. So I think you can't give in to raw fear, because it really is damaging. It's going to interfere, no pun intended, with your doing whatever it is you need to do to survive. And so some of us simply have to try to be strong. And I just am not going to, I'm not going to be done in by this. I'm going to, you know, I have to maintain a belief that we're going to continue to survive. Now, if we don't, then I'll face that at the time. But I'm not willing to make that concession. And I do think that there's some optimism with these people who are going to be our leaders. And I'm hopeful that that's going to make a difference. But I think you simply have to make a decision that you're going to survive. And that's the first thing. And everybody gets to say that. I'm going to survive, or guess what? I obviously am not going to make it, so I may as well just give up. I'm not going to say that. I'll go down with the ship still saying I'm going to survive. I'm not going to say that. And I'm going to carry on as if I'm going to survive. I'm not going to cancel my pledges. My economy's worse. I mean, everybody's hurting. You know, if you're trying to sell a house, you can't even sell it. You know, I mean, everybody, I don't care how well you're doing, we feel the impact of this. I have no idea how book sales are going to go. I mean, everybody has to wonder. But I'm not going to let it change the essential things I'm doing right now, because I think if people carry on, somehow we'll all carry on.
And on that note, thank you very much, Patricia, for taking part in this. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a great interview.